Du skal nu til at lytte til Bæk bag bolden, som er podcasten, der handler om hverdagen i topfodbold. Jeg forsøger at få samtaler med så dygtige mennesker, jeg nu kan få adgang til inden for sportens verden. Det kan være trænere, direktører, bestyrelsesmedlemmer, det kan være fodboldspillere. Det kan også være journalister eller agenter. Og det kan især være nogle af de mange specialister, der er involveret i et Superliga-trænerteam. I dag er jeg så heldig at skulle gøre det på engelsk, fordi jeg har fået besøg af Aaron Thode. Please welcome Aaron.
Thank you.
And we just discussed what was the correct title for what you do. You are athletic coach or strength and conditioner coach in Brøndby.
Correct.
And therefore we have a history before, which will hopefully not be to my disadvantage. It's certainly not for yours. And you have been working for how long in Brøndby?
Can't remember the exact year. I know my first full year was the year we survived relegation in Horsens.
Ah, yeah.
Under Awi Skobelius and Ben Turbo.
And you've been there ever since. So you survived quite a lot of head coaches, technical directors and CEOs and so forth. How did you get into not only Brøndby, but into football?
Football, actually grew up playing in the United States. It was by far not the most common sport. Me and a few Outlander friends decided to take it up with the leadership of a friend's parent. And just sort of became a passion. Played in high school. Tried to play in university. That was very English 8th league. Kickball, chaseball, hitman. But we were very effective. We were captain coached, and the school funded us just to drive from school to school on the weekends and play bar league football. And then after a long university stint, I got very into the physical side of study at the University of Colorado, and was fortunate enough to work with the women's team at the university, as well as cross-country, athletics, American football, a number of teams. But working with those girls sort of rekindled my passion and reminded me how much I like the sport, how unique it is to train, in terms of the individual skill sets, the position-specific stuff. And I decided I should probably try to work in the MLS. Mm-hmm. So I sent about 20 emails, made 40 phone calls to...
20 or 200? I didn't...
20.
20.
20. Wow. Made a lot of phone calls to MLS clubs, got no responses, which is fair at the time. I'm sure there was... I was one of hundreds searching for an internship position, big country. And I was fortunate enough to have extended family here. So they said, you have a bed. You're welcome to stay. They live in Alaholt. And so I arrived with a suitcase and a smile with the ambitions of an internship in Super League team, first division team, actually was pretty irrelevant to me. Just wanted to get European football on my CV.
Yeah.
And before I arrived, I had sent 214 emails, which I still have on a hard drive.
To whom?
I know the clubs that turned me down.
All over Europe?
No, just Denmark. Just Danish
214
clubs. Yeah, I didn't even understand the structure. So I didn't understand what is a technical director, if I could find a head coach's email, a physiotherapist, an assistant coach. I wrote people in the commercial department for clubs.
Oh boy, you might have sent one to me at that time anywhere.
Depends upon where you were.
Yeah, I don't remember at that time. But
yeah.
I'm sorry for that.
It's totally fine. You basically had to be within reaching distance of Alaholt via S-train.
Oh.
Because that was my only mode of transportation. So it was all first division clubs from AB, Lundby, Hobykur, of course, Brøndby, Copenhagen, Nordsjælland, and down the list. And after I arrived, I still hadn't had a response from any of the clubs. And so I just started the legwork again. and sent probably nothing shy of 100 more. Just went through the contacts list that I had created in a Word document and started firing them off. And I heard back from three clubs, actually, a guy by the name of Flemming Petersen, who was at Nordsjælland at the time, who is now the head coach. And I believe he was head of the youth department at the time. Heard back from someone in Brøndby and another individual in Copenhagen. And no job, no internship offer. And fortunately, just word of mouth and knocking on doors, someone mentioned that the women's team in Brøndby could possibly be looking for an athletic coach. And I met a great guy named Per Listhoff. And I went and worked with the women a few times and instantly enjoyed it. And he said, you're welcome to stay here if you want. We can't pay you anything. We can't provide transportation. You're welcome to come to the games on the bus with us. And but ultimately, that's what I was searching for when I came here. So it was a perfect opportunity, and ended up meeting a wonderful group of girls. And we ended
up quite successful as well, right?
Yeah, we won the double my first year. And then the men's team took me on as an assistant after. Probably because there was some interest from the other side of town to work with the youth department. And I stayed with the women actually for two additional years while I was with the men's team as well. And we had three doubles in a row. It was a fantastic period.
So it took a lot of persistence,
yes,
and patience from your side to get into football. And then at the end, it was primarily as a volunteer that gave you the chance to show your skills.
Yeah. Correct?
And when people are asking, and some people would be asking, because listeners at this podcast can write me questions or wishes for future guests, and a lot of listeners ask, how can we get into football? And your advice would be persistency and patience, and of course accept to be a volunteer for a while until you might create your own job.
Yeah, and just take the risk. I mean, the worst thing that happens is someone says no.
Yeah.
And that's not, it's debilitating in the moment maybe. But if you ask it enough times and you're persistent enough, knock on enough doors, eventually someone will probably give you the opportunity.
So now you are working with the men's team in Brøndby, one of the biggest clubs in the country, one of the best teams in the country, and you have a responsibility that has been growing over the years, no longer assistant. You're now in a setup with a lot of other people around you, and you're working in which areas? Maybe you could describe what your responsibilities would be, and later I'd ask you about the daily routines Monday to Sunday.
Overall responsibility, maintain and understand the fitness of the team. That's primary number one. Have conversations with each individual and understand their individual status physically. Be responsible for communicating to the coaches which direction maybe we should be heading in the next few weeks, in terms of the game loading, the training loading, etc. Also a big responsibility to look backwards in the previous 2 weeks. I see my job as sort of trying to assist the coaches and put the pieces together so that the puzzle makes sense in terms of the physical loading.
So maintain and understand the fitness of the team. What means do you use to understand and to have the full picture of the fitness? You have data, you have colleagues, and you have science that you studied. How do you scan the fitness level of the team and the individual?
Initially, we do a lot of testing with the players.
How often would that be?
At the moment, about four times a year. depending upon schedule. This year with the corona situation, it's been different. Mm-hmm. But minimum four, beginning of each preseason. And at the end of a half season, Denmark has a very unique playing schedule. So we actually have the two preseasons built in. And then if someone's coming back from injury, we'll try to sneak some additional testing in if possible.
What kind of test would that be? Not the corona test as it is right now, once a week, but what kind of testing?
Simple things from body fat measurement. The most complex probably being the VO2 max and blood lactate tests. Those are two good ways to assess the individual's aerobic fitness. We do strength training tests predominantly in mid-year with some of the players, just to see that after the high amount of game loading, they are maintaining their overall strength and power, and that we're not moving too far from that. We have a power plate test as well, which we use primarily for information if a player gets injured.
What is a power plate?
It's like a seated leg press, and we take each leg individually. Mm-hmm. The player pushes as hard as they can three times, and then what we have is essentially the individual's baseline. So if somebody has a knee issue and we're trying to reintegrate, we can see that the right knee, for example, is only at 80% capacity of what it was pre-injury. So it's just a good way to get a better overall understanding of what's going on inside.
Jump test?
We do jump tests. We do sprint tests. We generally do those after the first or second week of preseason. Mm-hmm. Like to get the guys on the pitch, let them move a little bit, let them have some more natural actions before we go directly into the maximum power, just to try to avoid muscle injuries.
Yeah. Can I ask you? I believe that there would be people very interested in the technical part of this. The body fat measurement. Mm-hmm. Back in time, we used this, I don't know the English word for it. In Danish, it would be a tank. You know, to physically measure the amount of fat caught in between this tank in Danish. What would that be in English? No,
caliper.
Yeah,
and we do actually still use that method. Mm. While it's not maybe the most accurate tool on the market, it's a good way to see where our players individually. Of course, we could take them to a university and put them in a DEXA scan machine, do the water submersion test, something like that. But with the resources you have in the club, you also want to make it fast, accessible, easy to do in a short amount of time.
Yeah.
So what we're generally searching for with a test like that is just a player's consistency in body mass index.
Yeah. Okay. All right. And if a player would have an insufficient test, he would be asked to go on a diet, or what would you do about it?
Depends upon what time of year it is.
Sure.
I like to make guys work if they come back, especially from a winter holiday. That's historically where we've seen most of the growth in BMI, mostly because of the length of holiday. A lot of the food surrounding that time of year as well. I've thrown 7 a.m., 7:30 bike units at guys, just low intensity weight management. You know, but fortunately, it's one of those message situations where if enough guys see one or two guys doing that, the problem sort of takes care of itself in the future. But I find that that's not really an issue with the modern athlete.
No.
I think, you know, clubs have good dietary information. Some have private chefs, etc. A lot of resources to give the guys information. I think the days of guys going to Ibiza and drinking for 6 weeks is pretty far gone. I think that's culturally in Denmark anyway. I can't speak for other nations.
Would you be part of that particular job, maintaining fitness is one part, but the correct nutrition, and is that part of your responsibility?
I provide as much sound knowledge as I can within my area of expertise and within my knowledge base, but I am by no means an educated dietist or nutritionist. That is an entirely different level of science. Of course, the two are very closely tied, and I can give base info. But if a player comes with a serious problem or they have some major dietary restrictions, then I will always consult somebody else.
And I know that in your club in Brøndby, you have hired a chef that will provide all the meals given to the players in the club. Would you have any collaboration with the chef regarding if you see a problem, if you see tendencies for fat level growing or whatever, energy level getting smaller? Would you have any conversation with him, or is it somebody else in the staff doing that?
Generally myself or Peter, the head physio, also head of medical, would have the conversation. But we've given Benji, he's a wonderful chef, wonderful guy, a template to go off of that sort of mirrors our workload throughout the course of the week. And then he looks at the substrates or the types of calories that we're searching for to refuel or fuel the players.
To your experience, is what is usually the biggest problem for players in nutrition? Is that eating too much or eating too little?
With the group of guys that I have currently, it can be eating too little. The training load is quite extensive, and it's hard to get enough calories in. Can be. I think hydration actually would probably be the biggest issue throughout football, nutrition-wise, I think in a lot of ways. There's a lot of different climates. You have different seasons. You have different training loads, different schedules. There's a lot of bigger clubs that have bigger staffs that actually just have specifically a hydration specialist on staff.
And we know you in Brøndby at my time, I remember we worked a little bit on that because, as you say, it's more limiting for the performance level to be out of hydration than anything else, maybe. Yeah. Even lack of sleep. Anyway, the VO2 max and the lactacid test you talked about, the VO2 max, usually in Denmark you would have to go to the hospital or to the university to have that performed, but that's not the case in Brøndby, is it?
No.
How do you do it?
We have a specific computer assigned to a treadmill in a dark room, which the players don't enjoy. And we have two scientists down there barking at them all day. But it's essentially, it starts with a low intensity walk where they have a airtight mask fixed over their both nose and mouth, wraps around the back of the head, and then the speed gradually increases over the course of 2 kilometer increments every 3 minutes until we get to 18 kilometers an hour. And we have small needles that draw tiny blood samples in between each one of those 3 minute intervals. The machine does most of the work. It analyzes what the player's doing, monitors him throughout the course of the test, and then afterward we get a report based on his amount of oxygen per milliliter per minute of kilogram body weight. The computer doesn't.
luckily.
Yeah.
And if it makes a mistake, it makes the same mistake every time, so it's trustworthy.
Correct.
Yeah. And the lactacid test.
Yes.
Not many clubs use that anymore in football. Maybe in biking, but in football, I find it very rarely anymore. Do you know what you use it for? Is there any purpose for it?
It is an aerobic test, just like the VO2 max test. We adopted it after Erzoniger arrived from Germany. It's still commonly used by many Bundesliga teams. I think all Bundesliga teams at the moment. And what it is just it's another way of assessing base aerobic fitness levels. I like the combination of the two together. I will admit that I was hesitant to get involved with it in the beginning. But after you spend some time with it, you realize that there's players that show growth in different ways. So some guys that would look like relatively low responders or non-responders, given a preseason periodization, they might show really good growth from the lactate threshold, which essentially is their body being able to buffer and use hydrogen within the Krebs cycle for a longer period of time. So acceptance. What they don't get is that sua or acid.
And then the strength test you talked about earlier. I always, as a coach, as a head coach, was very afraid of the strength test because I find it very often that the players, the technique of the players would maybe not be 100%. So if they try to give 100% in loading, the lack of technique might cause injuries. How do you do that? 3 times 90% of the top load? Or do you, are you expecting them to do one lift?
No, much less. Closer to 5 or 6 repetitions.
Okay. So the maximum amount of kilos they can do 5 or 6 repetitions.
Yeah.
And then you calculate it into what is the maximum load.
Oh, correct. And it's something we would generally only do with young developing players just to ensure that we are moving in the right direction.
Yeah.
Because some of the guys, because they are young, don't gain weight the way we'd like them to. But if we know that they are in fact getting stronger, then we know that we're working in the right direction. If we see a double non-response, then we need to scrap what we're doing. We were wrong. That happens. It's okay. And find a better way to work with this individual.
And the power plate is, there's no risk. As I remember it, you just push as hard as you can and you can't make it incorrect.
Yeah. I mean, you can generate actually very little power. I can generate very little power. There's probably quite a few guys who could, I think every player could outdo me at the moment. There's very little risk. You don't even fully extend the leg. You're in the seated position. It's just, good baseline information.
And the jump and sprint tests, they are also done in-house. What tool do you need use for that?
The jump test, we just have the common jump plate. Just measures the amount of time that a player separates from the jumping pad. You can do any number of different jumping styles. We generally go with the fixed, hands on the hip, bend, accelerate upward as fast as possible. And then we do the sprint test is a 30-meter test. And then we have these laser gates separated every 5-10 meters or so. More in the beginning, less at the end. And then we'd see you can draw close to a top speed for an individual. But more importantly, you can see where the individual accelerates the fastest and where they sort of plateau. So then you get an idea of, is this individual extremely explosive and then reaches peak velocity after 20 meters? Then we know how to work with that individual. Or, okay, this guy has a relatively decent top speed, but his first 15 meters are actually rubbish. So that's where we would concentrate more on a heavier lifting program, for example, to try to increase acceleration.
Okay. So from all of the things you're testing, what would be the more difficult thing to improve, and what would be the easiest thing to improve? If you, maybe the question is too wide or broad.
Easiest thing to improve, strength.
Yeah.
A lot of other aspects that people, for whatever reason, talk around and don't really want to address is a lot of the attributes that a football has physically are largely genetic. And that can be from your BMI, very much so from your aerobic capacity or VO2 max, and without a doubt, non-arguably, speed. So I would say speed is by far the hardest thing to change and the most common thing that a coach asks for.
Yeah. And therefore, it's a bit sad that you would have the most difficult task in dealing with what is most required from the coaches.
Yeah.
Speed.
Well, it's, guys do get faster. I mean, if you bring up a 19-year-old, he's the athlete's generally going to continue to get faster until he's about 25, 26 once they reach their athletic peak. So they will get faster. It's just not as rapidly as they would prefer. You smile.
Yeah, but that's the thing. That's the thing, because yeah. in a former episode of this podcast, we were talking to scouting to scouts about what to look for, and speed is definitely the number one thing since it's so difficult to change, and that's, well, that's for another talk maybe. Yeah. All right, so that is the picture of the player you create when you said you would be maintaining and understanding the fitness level of the team or the individual. That would be through testing. What about the daily loading of the players? I mean, I know you use data from every training session. Which importance does that have? What influence does that have on your daily routines for you?
The tracking system we use now is a Dutch system called Emotio. It's a radio frequency system. It provides, I think, 100 pings per second. So it's one of the most accurate on the planet. It's a lot of data.
Yeah, it is.
And if you're not careful, you can end up swimming in it. Mm. It took us, to be fair, probably a year and a half, along with some good interns, to really sort of finalize the project and be able to draw good knowledge from it. With that, we just try to create a flow or rhythm of what a training week looks like with a given trainer. From there, we can assign specific drills to specific days in order to make a day more intensive, less intensive, etc. So with the ultimate goal of having the players arrive fresh. Fish too. Fish and fresh. Yeah. On game day.
Yeah. I remember I was there when we introduced the Emotio system, and one of the main aims at that time would have been that you can actually measure quite accurate as you train, as you go along, what the loading is, and if that's what you actually expected, and if it's not, you can correct it as you go. In contrast to what we usually had before, when you after training could be evaluating on what they did, but you couldn't change anything until next training.
Yeah.
How far have you come in that direction? Do you have people watching the session on the computer and saying, "Oh, Paul needs to step up now"? And
yeah, since we've had the system, we've walked around with it daily. I think the things where it assists the most is, okay, we're searching for sprints and high intense meters within this drill. Mm. The pitch is a bit small, you know, for the number of guys we have in here in the space provided. So let's move the tops. Let's open up the space a little bit and let's let them get some speed exposure. So I think it just makes hitting your targets for each specific drill and each specific unit that much easier.
And in the ideal of worlds, you would have experience with the individual player and the routines, the exercises they usually do, so you can actually predict what the loading might be for Paul tomorrow as we do this drill and that session. Is that also part of the work now, that you can predict Paul's loading not only today but the loading from the program for tomorrow as well? Is that possible?
Yeah, and it's that way with every player. Yeah. Each player's data sort of tells a story about the individual, and the more data you collect, the more clear that story becomes. And you know who your outliers are going to be, both on the high end and on the low end, which is normal. Guys have highs, guys have lows. What we search for within that story is a guy who's deviating from the norm. a guy who's falling too far away, for example, and we can see this consistently throughout the course of the week. Mm-hmm. He might not be in pain, he might not be training that poorly, but something isn't 100% there. And therefore, that's the good lead-in to begin the conversation with the player about where he's at.
So your role in that perspective, you would be collaborating with somebody about this. Not only you would not be collecting the data, somebody will and structure it and to interpret the data. Mm-hmm. You would do that, or you would do that collaborating with other staff members?
We have a series of interns from Sudensk who actually start the system every day when we begin training. Mm. Then they create a report. Mm. I can also see the data live on the tablet, so I can have dialogue with a player on the fly or with the coaches to make changes, adjust if necessary. But then that report is delivered to me, and then if there is something that is outlying or something that needs to be changed, then it goes, depending upon the situation, to head of medical, maybe to some members of the coaching team, whoever's most important in having influence over that individual.
All right. So now I have, hopefully the listeners would have a picture as well of how you understand and maintain the fitness level using all this information and of course the trained eye you have when you're on the pitch with the players. That could never replace the data could never replace that trained eye, I suppose. So what would a daily routine, no, let's take a week. What would the routines for you be from, you know, Monday to Sunday? What would your rhythm in the club would be?
Did we play the previous Sunday?
Yeah.
Is there a training?
We are recording now on Monday and we had a game yesterday. What was going on today? What is going to be the next day's? You have a full week this week until the next game?
Yeah. First thing first, get a status from all players. Mm-hmm. See where they're at. Mm-hmm. The guys that got heavily loaded on Sunday, played 60 or more minutes, understanding of how they felt in the game. How do they feel now? Mm-hmm. What about the day moving forward? The guys that weren't as heavily stimulated on match day, we'll design a specific training for them, and we'll try to mirror what the guys had the previous day as closely as possible so that we can keep everybody on relatively a similar fitness form. Mm-hmm. Because the coaches, my job is ultimately to provide as many people as possible to the coaching staff, give them 100% options in terms of limited injury and fit players.
And if you should, that would be a scale, you know, from extremely fit players to extremely not injured players. Mm-hmm. If you can, now I make the scale in the room. You can, only the two of us can see it. But if you should put yourself on that scale, what would your priority be? Less risk, less injuries, or more fit, more training to the limit?
More fit players generally don't get injured. That's my experience. I think injuries come in the form of two types of individuals, the understimulated or undertrained, and the completely overstimulated or overused. That generally comes with a heavy European match, which coincides with a lot of travel and also a lot of league play. The undertrained generally comes maybe on during a transfer window when a guy was in limbo, not knowing where he was going to end up, falls into your hands. How fit are you? Very fit. Okay. You don't know a lot about the individual. You're sort of trying to piece together what he's been doing in the last couple of weeks. That's a risk area as well.
So the more confusion or worries mentally will inflict on more injuries physically. Is that what you're saying? Could be.
Could be.
Not necessarily.
No.
Uh-huh. So now we just had a period with a lot of games in a very short time. Usually you would be worried for injuries in that period, but you're also introducing to me now that in the transfer period, with players not being sure whether they're going to continue in this club or change for another, that period they could be vulnerable to injuries as well.
Yeah,
oh, that's two different perspectives. I see. Anyway, so you prefer more fit players, as that will prevent more injuries.
Yeah, coming. Fitness creates robustness.
Yeah,
and robustness is the ability to train and perform regularly.
But the discussion, how hard to push to become fit in a safe way, is a very common discussion between you and coaches, I suppose. Would have been if I had been coaching with you.
Yeah, it can be. I think now, in my time in Brøndby, the sports science or athletic training has become so specific. I think that a lot of coaches now, especially from the younger generation, really sort of just say, this is your area. This is your jam. You tell us what to do. If it doesn't coincide, sorry. But I think most are just searching for the best leadership possible and best advice. I mean, we all have the same ultimate goal. Right, winning games.
But surely, as you have been now working with, I think you told me, six different coaches in your time in Brøndby, that would be different expectations to you and different space to perform your science and your knowledge. I'm not trying to ask what coach were the better. It's not that thing. But to your experience, is there a big variation of how much time in training, how much time in preparing the training you would have from coach to coach?
I think the biggest difference coach to coach is actually what they're searching for within the game. And with a lot of coaching changes, that becomes a big part of your job, is actually understand the specific tasks of the team, the specific roles of each individual and position. What his drills look like. Are they incredibly intensive? Are they very long? Are they very short? And then it's my job to piece together his information or the information provided and try to assist him in the best way possible.
And therefore, understanding not only the level, fitness level of the players, but also the expectation from the coaching staff is a guiding line for your job, of course. I understand.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We're working within their structure and we're aiding them as best as we possibly can.
And now, not speaking of Brøndby, but of football in general, since coaching staffs would change quite rapidly, can you see a future, or maybe it's already like that in your club? Can you see a situation where you are actually telling the coaching staff what system they would have at hand, what kind of tool they can use, and that this is the expectations from the club to the coach, not always the other way around, that the coach would have expectations to the staff from the club, but this is the club standards given to the coaching?
It could be. I think that's become a pretty common structure in Germany, where clubs have a blueprint and then they select coaches specifically that coincide within that specific playing style or task. Whichever direction the club chooses to do isn't up to me.
Do you have an advice? We're still not talking about Brøndby, but in general?
I will say that the most difficult, or it's a double-edged sword. The thing that's given me the most experience is so much exposure to different coaches, different playing styles, different methodology, seeing the game in different ways, seeing athletes in different ways. And I have a long list of people to thank from that, from Skabalios and Capellas and Frank and Zoniga and Niels and everyone in between. But it also creates the greatest difficulty, because we as a physical staff can actually lose time on trying to understand the specific tasks or what is the blueprint for a specific week. Yeah. And then we have to circumvent and assess and execute as quickly as possible with the information we have. And for the players, that can equal at times time lost. But I think I've been fortunate to be with Peter and Morten for a very long time now. Have a really good working relationship with them, and the consistency within our department, I think, has been our greatest asset and strength. We know how each individual wants to work, how we communicate to each other, and how we get the players going in the best way possible.
Would you? Would your tasks, of course, they will. Would your responsibility change over the year, the periodization, is that the word in English? Mm-hmm. For the work you would be doing, of course, would change from in-season and out-season, or if you are still in Europe or not, yeah. The amount of games. But would that also give you a bigger influence on the training out of season rather than in-season? Can you tell the difference between being in and out of season?
Yeah, absolutely. Out of season, there's just a lot of volume. There is under my paradigm scheme. I believe in a lot of training. I like to start with low intensity, gradually increase over the course of 4 weeks. A lot of training units.
How many? What is a lot of training units in 4 weeks' time? How much would you guess?
Let's see. We would have minimum 30 over the course of 3 weeks.
3 weeks, yeah.
3 weeks. Mm-mm. That would be our average preseason. Yeah. Very rarely have we had 4 to 6 weeks. I think it's been some seasons.
True.
I think we had under Zoniga once we had, I believe, 38 total units in a winter training period.
He wasn't afraid of training three times a day.
No.
In training camp.
No.
I get it.
And it's, I don't know if there's, it's not my job to have a right or a wrong, or to say what is best. I think it's, what is best is what is most applicable for the team and what they're trying to accomplish. I prefer to train a lot. I think it creates robustness and limits injuries. Ultimately that's the job.
So in that time of year, of course, aerob capacity is quite important.
Sure.
And I've seen you go in a lot of times with the players in the woods.
Yes.
I was not thinking you would hide from me what you were doing, but yeah. You need some space when you want to cover big ground. And I got that totally. During season, how much work would you do off the pitch with the players?
Almost all work off the pitch is exclusively limited to the gym.
I see. How often are you in the gym with the players?
With the young guys, 4 days a week.
Young guys would be under 21?
Yeah, anywhere from 17, 18 to 23, depending upon physical development. If a guy's really physically developed at an extremely young age, we'll back off and not spend as much time with him in there. But I like to have 2 leg units and 2 upper body units with the young guys per week. The older guys, the road is set. It's just about keeping them sharp as possible and trying to fine tune the engine in any way we can.
Okay, and for I mean, when speed is so important, how much training would you do in a week that could actually provide speed for the individual? And is it only gym or is it on the pitch as well?
No, we do it on the pitch as well. I prefer to have it built into football training drills to make it as position specific or athlete relevant as possible. We could go out on a track and just sprint for 100 meters, but
the amount of times very seldomly sprint 100 meters in a game.
Absolutely. So I like to do that Wednesdays on match day -4 to try to to separate the speed exposure as much as possible to the match day.
Because of the loading, the impact of it?
Yeah, you can get a two-day reaction if you have a really intensive unit. So I like to let the guys cool down and separate from that loading as much as possible. I'll normally couple the strength on that day as well. I just don't want any residue. It's okay to be a little heavy-ish on Friday. Saturday, I'd like them feeling relatively light and spritzy, to throw in a German term. And then Sunday, I just want them to pop and feel fresh.
So that'll create the rhythm of the week. Four times for the younger, maybe twice for the older in the gym.
Yeah.
Heavily sprinting Wednesday, if it's match day minus four. Less aerob capacity than out of season.
Yeah, correct? Without a doubt. Yeah. And the aerob capacity and maintenance is again built in within the football itself. Yeah. That can be in the form of wandos or possession games on Thursdays. I like to have some bigger areas there and just let the guys have a good breathe for some long intervals, bring them up into the 90s for a while, and then cool them down.
Yeah. So looking at the week and starting from the first sentence you actually said, maintain and understand the fitness level of the team, and you're testing four times a year, most likely four times a year. So in order to keep body fat low, that was one test, just the amount of training should help them, and the communication with the chef should do with that. Yeah. The VO2 max would be the football as such. It's game specific. It's not only from the games, but also in the last part of the week, correct?
Yes.
And the strength test you were doing to make sure they have a better test next time, that's two or four times a week in the gym. And the power plate is the same thing, because that is a specific thigh, knee test, right?
Yeah.
And the jump and sprint test would be resulting from the gym, most likely. And of course, football as such.
Yeah, I think almost all footballers exclusively have speed increases because of them moving more into their athletic peak, but also from football-specific actions. I think very few footballers would lift in a way that would dramatically show big increases in speed. Most of it comes from sprint-specific actions on the pitch.
Great. And to conclude this this talk about the fitness training in a top team in football, being an American, I remember when I've watched American football develop, but still today I think it's applicable to American football. That is not American football, but soccer. Right?
Yeah.
The physical part plays a much bigger role in American soccer than in European football. That's
correct.
What I've seen. Would you say that, to your experience, that Danish players are coachable, very willing to do the physical part of their training compared to what you know from the States?
The younger generation is very easy to work with, because culturally it's been a part of their lives in their development within our club. That's the only that's what I can speak to.
Younger than 23?
Let's say 26, 27. Okay. You know, it's been instilled in the program for a pretty long time there. American soccer is different in the sense that we often isolate and find an athlete and then teach them to play a specific sport. Whereas in Europe, the coaching is at a much higher level, so it's a lot of coaching, education, development of the sport, and then the athlete rises from there. So it's a different philosophy, and I think it stems largely from there not being enough good coaching in the U.S. because the sport is so new, and I think that with time we'll adopt a much more European model in the near future.
And that is what it's all about, right? Learning from other cultures. And that's why we should appreciate that when we have the chance now with an American fitness coach, in Danish football, we have new impulses, and that should be embraced and used for the progress. Yeah. Aaron, thank you so much for showing up. And of course, this is only audio. Nobody can see how annoyingly fit you still are at the age of 38. So you actually walk the talk, which is always good. Thank you for showing up, Aaron. And for the guys, should girls as well listen to this podcast, you should all be very welcome. You still have a chance, as it was said in the beginning, to make a comment, make a suggestion to what can be next topic or next guest. You can use Trolspæk.com to make your comment or suggestions. And now I should be in Danish. For alle jer, der har lyttet med, tak skal I have. Det sker igen næste tirsdag.